Water quality and quantity is a pressing issue, even in resource-rich Wisconsin.
Writer Eric Ness focused on a particular region under debate in his November story in Milwaukee Magazine. Ness explores the Central Sands region in Till the Well Runs Dry. The eight-county region boasts 300 lakes and 800 miles of trout streams.
Those natural wonders are sometimes at odds with what has become an agricultural heartland, fed by a massive network of irrigation and wells. Ness tells Lake Effect's Susan Bentz that the complexity of the Central Sands water issues are linked to the region's geological history.
At the end of the last great glaciation, a little lobe of the Green Bay Glacier slipped under and dammed the Wisconsin River. And so as the glacier was melting, you had this ice dam at the other end. And so all of this sand and gravel was washing into this great Wisconsin lake, what they called Glacial Lake Wisconsin, and it settled to the bottom, kind of like a huge sandbox. The gravel and sand is about a 100-foot layer on top of the bedrock, and when that dam broke, it carved out what we now know as the Wisconsin River, but it also left behind this big sandbox and sort of laid the table for, you know, a spectacular natural area, but also the groundwater problems that they're facing today.
So agriculture obviously is a big, big operation thanks to irrigation and high-capacity wells.
Yeah, people had tried to make a go of farming in the region for more than 100 years. You know, in a sandy soil, things grow well in it, but you have to water it constantly. After the end of World War II, the aluminum industry had gotten such a boost through wartime production, and they were looking around for businesses, and they realized that, oh, we could make these center point irrigation systems. In 1950, there were fewer than 100 of these wells in the Central Sands region. Now there are more than 3,000, with more going in every year. And so we should talk for a minute about what a high-capacity well is.
Absolutely.
It's defined by the state as one that pumps 100,000 gallons or more of water a day.
And you gave the example, I think, that that's equivalent to what an average family might use in a year?
Mm-hmm. An average family in the United States. I mean,
that's true.
There are many people who get by with a great deal less. But you always have to go back to the geology. There are places, for example, people have heard of the Ogallala Aquifer in Kansas, which is a very deep aquifer that is essentially being mined by farmers in Kansas. So every time they pump water out of the Ogallala Aquifer, there is less of it overall. And there is a definite endpoint where that aquifer will not be able to be used for agriculture anymore. That is not the case in the Sand County region. We have a lot of water in that area. It's a very water-rich area. But again, we get back to the sand. You know, we've all been on a beach, dug a hole, and it fills with water because we found what hydrologists call the water table. Now, as the tide goes out, what happens to that water table? It goes down. And that's essentially the challenge that we face with the lakes and rivers in the Central Sands region, because they sit at the very top of the aquifer there. When we put in 3,000 high-capacity wells, and all of them are pulling, there's still a ton of water left in that aquifer, just not at the surface.
So there's the uniqueness of that region, and then there's the policy around high-capacity wells that has been evolved and challenged in Wisconsin over the last years. Would you start there with Lake Beulah or before that?
The most important thing may be to actually talk about the Great Lakes Compact, which...
Excellent.
So the Great Lakes Compact was an attempt by the states to come to some sort of uniform management agreement. It's anticipated that there's going to be lots of pressure in a water-scarce future on this incredible freshwater resources. So at that point in time, the state legislature realized its groundwater laws were woefully inadequate for the kind of management challenges that they were going to be facing in the future, especially under the Great Lakes Compact. And so in 2003 and 2004, the legislature did a sort of first revision of the state's groundwater law. It was passed virtually unanimously.
Bipartisan effort.
Not only was it a bipartisan effort, but there were forums held all over this state a civil and civic conversation about what water is, how important it is, what we can do to manage it, that played out all over the state. And it was agreed by members of both parties that they were only partway done, that they were going to need to come back and address the issue in a few more years.
This is where Lake Beulah fits in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were attempts to write the next generation of groundwater legislation, but they basically stalled. So along comes the Wisconsin Supreme Court in a case about a small lake.
Lake Beulah is located nowhere near the Central Sands. It's in
Yes.
southeastern Wisconsin in the Kettle Moraine.
We don't want to get lost in the weeds
of
this specific decision here. What I think is remarkable about the Lake Beulah decision was the Supreme Court's decision to reiterate Wisconsin's history with respect to water. And it goes all the way back to the Northwest Territories Act, before Wisconsin was even a state. Our legislators in Washington, D.C. were very focused on our ability to travel on rivers, because that was the economic lifeblood of the region. And so they inserted this little phrase about, you know, our access to the rivers being forever free. Now, when Wisconsin became a state, our young citizens took that exact phrase and put it in the state constitution. That whole idea of public access to the waterways has been increasingly refined and added to. Again, in 2011, with the Supreme Court decision of Lake Beulah, they reiterated all of this and added to that the observation that groundwater is clearly connected to surface water, and the DNR needs to find a way to take that into account when it issues its rulings on high-capacity wells.
So, Eric, let's circle back. Part of the debate in the Central Sands has been the Little Plover River. It's become sort of a symbol of
right.
the two sides of the story.
Yeah. So I would encourage any listeners who have a browser available to them to go online and type in the words Little Plover River Test Pump. The first result that you'll find is a YouTube video of a 1963 training film produced by the U.S. Geological Survey about the Little Plover River. What's fascinating about it, 1963, so more than 50 years ago, and they're running an experiment where they put a high-capacity well right next to the Little Plover River. They pump an awful lot of water out of it and watch the river go down. And then they stop the pumping and watch the river come back up. Now, the Little Plover River is a tiny river, less than 10 miles long. It has no tributaries. It is also one of the most studied rivers in the United States. It's just such an interesting hydrogeological phenomenon. It's got beautiful sandy bottoms, wonderful trout population. And in 2013, it was listed as one of the 10 most endangered rivers in the United States. But the thing is that we could see all of this coming. You know, the studies that the movie shows were the first round, but in 1971, they released another study where they said, you know, if agricultural pumping keeps going up and we have a drought year, the headwaters of some of these rivers in this region are going to fail. In 1996, when the village of Little Plover put in a new municipal well in the Little Plover River watershed, scientists at Stevens Point, UW-Stevens Point, ran the numbers, and they said, when this well gets to full capacity, the Little Plover River is going to start to run dry. And it did in 2005. And it has run dangerously low almost every year since, which is why it is considered one of the most endangered rivers in America. So you might think that there's no solution for this. You know, we just have to choose the river or choose the water for the people. But we have yet another science project going forward. Ken Bradbury, a UW hydrogeologist, is basically doing the same kind of study that's been done a few times. He laughs at this. He knows he's treading over old ground. But what he is bringing to it is new computer power. And when they are done modeling the Little Plover River, it is conceivable that they're going to be able to help the region optimize its water use.
You also mentioned in the article some farmers are experimenting, that they're looking into new technologies and new information.
Exactly. It's easy to look at farmers in a stereotypical way and just assume they're putting too much water on the field. But what you have to understand about energy costs these days is that just pulling the water from the ground is enormously expensive. And so farmers have every economic reason to try to optimize their water consumption. But I think what we're running up against, again, is this political divide, this inability to talk about the problem. Because that's the thing about this whole optimization strategy. It involves coordinated work by scientists, by farmers, by municipalities, by everyone who's using water. They have to share information. They have to share power. They have to give up the option to throw on the tap on a given day. Like I said, I think it's hard for environmentalists to trust that we're getting there because stalling has been such a big part of the opposition tactics. And I think it's hard for businesses to trust because they figure that there'll always just be another lawsuit around the corner.
Eric Ness's article on water issues in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin is in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, and there is a link to the interview from WUWM.com/lakeeffect.